away. They turned their heads to see the dog standing there, tail waving slowly, and with an almost apologetic look on his face. "Speak of the devil," Ben said, and very reluctantly eased away from Cassie. By the time he let the dog out for a last run, reset the security system, and made sure the fire they had earlier abandoned in the fireplace was banked for the night, Ben wouldn't have been surprised to find Cassie asleep again. But she was only drowsy, and came into his arms eagerly as soon as he slid into bed beside her. "What kept you?" she murmured. "While you were gone, the music came back." "Max wanted another rawhide bone." Ben kissed her, hardly surprised to find that he wanted her again, and every bit as urgently as the first time. Cassie wreathed her arms around his neck. "Stop talking about the dog." Both of them forgot the dog. And the music. His shoulder made a comfortable pillow, and his body against hers was a pleasure Cassie thought she could drown herself in. She was vaguely aware of sleet rattling against the window panes, of the occasional whine of the wind, but most of her consciousness was focused on the deep and even sounds of Ben's breathing. "He'll destroy you," came the whisper from the grave. "I don't care," Cassie whispered in reply. Chapter 18. February 28th, 1999. "I wish you'd come to the station with me," Matt said restlessly, watching Abby pour herself a second cup of coffee. "Any other Sunday I would, but Anne can't be there today, and I have to play the organ. Matt, surely you aren't worried about me being at the church. There'll be people all around, you know that." "Ivy Jameson was killed before she could get to church last Sunday." "Well, you've already said you're taking me, so I should get there safely." She smiled at him. "And since you're taking me, you can come pick me up afterward."
"You don't have to worry about that."
Abby reached across the table to touch his hand. "I'll be fine, Matt. And you need to be at the station. We both know that. If what you suspect is right, you need to check all the notes on the first three murders."
"I don't know if it'll get us anywhere," he confessed. "Maybe a step or two closer to understanding this son of a bitch. But I have to check it out."
Reluctantly, Abby said, "And you'll have the autopsy report on the Ramsey girl to go over as well." He grimaced.
"I'm not looking forward to that. And I don't expect it to help us much. Even though she was left in pieces, you could still see the ligature mark on her neck. I figure the report will tell me Cassie was right about that as well. He strangled the girl with a garrote."
"What about Cassie?" Abby said. "Are you still planning to ask her and Ben to come to the station?"
"If I'm right about the missing articles. Don't know that it'll help. But I think we need to talk over a few things. And maybe Cassie will be able to contact the killer."
"What about Bishop?"
Matt shrugged. "It was what he noticed at the murder scene yesterday that got me thinking. His expertise may come in handy. And at this point, I'm not too proud to ask for help. As long as he doesn't drag the Bureau in with him. So, sure, why not?"
In fact, Matt called Bishop's motel room from his cruiser as he drove Abby to church, and the agent arrived at the station just minutes after Matt settled at his desk.
"Postmortem?"
Bishop asked, noting the papers the sheriff was studying.
"Yeah. She was strangled with a thin wire or something similar. Cassie was right about that. And something else. He killed the girl while he was raping her."
Bishop sat down on the leather sofa.
"A first for him, right?"
"Right. No established sexual contact with the first three victims, although Cassie says this sort of murder is always sexual,
And the reading I've done seems to agree with her. You've seen the reports. What do you think?
She's right. It's about power. And that usually translates into sexual domination.
The agent thought a moment.
A bit surprising that he apparently didn't attempt sexual domination with the first three. But he may well have achieved satisfaction observing their terror before and during the murders.
It was Matt's turn to consider.
Cassie also claims that when Jill Kirkwood was killed, third victim, the killer wore some kind of Halloween mask. We have no idea if he also wore one when he killed the first two victims, or the fourth, for that matter. He may have tried the mask to elicit more terror from his victim. If that's so, if he wore it only that time, and not before or after, then he may be only beginning to shape and perfect his M.O.
What a cheerful possibility, Matt said.
A reasonable one, I'm afraid. He kills because he likes to kill, and each experience gives him more ideas for his next murder.
Bishop's voice was remote.
We may never know what triggered his compulsion, what pushed him over the line from fantasizing to acting out his fantasies. Whatever's driving him is obviously growing stronger and more complex. The first victim wasn't physically tortured, though we can assume he did his best to terrify her emotionally before he cut her throat. The second victim either fought him, with a certain amount of success, or else he fully intended to allow himself a bloody rampage, just to find out how it felt.
Christ, Matt muttered.
Interesting that he followed that indulgence with a much calmer and quieter murder, and that he may have worn a mask expressly designed to terrify his victim. He was undoubtedly exhausted after killing the Jameson woman, yet he was obviously unsatisfied.
Matt snorted.
Ivy probably never satisfied a man in her life, even with her death.
Bishop smiled faintly.
Yes. She's the victim who stands out among the rest, doesn't she?
Matt leaned back in his chair.
Are you saying that might mean something?
I wouldn't be surprised.
The other victims ranged in age from 15 to 32. Jameson was considerably older. The other victims were quite attractive by any yardstick. Jameson was not. She was the only one killed in her home, and she may have let the killer into the house. And while the Ramsey girl was dismembered in an apparently violent rage, it's important to note that he killed her first. Jameson died in the struggle that left the crime scene a bloody mess. So he may have had some reason to hate Ivy in particular, which is why he chose her. Is that what you mean?
It's a possibility.
The other three victims seem to have been chosen by some combination of appearance and vulnerability, but Jameson doesn't fit into that. Wouldn't hurt to try to figure out why.
Matt nodded.
Okay. I'll send a few of my people out to question the neighbors and her acquaintances one more time. Ivy pissed off people on a regular basis, though, so narrowing the field might take a while.
In the meantime, have you found out whether there were missing items from the first three victims?
Yeah, it looks like there are, and I could kick myself for not asking sooner.
It won't make any difference until you have a viable suspect. It probably won't tell us anything helpful about the killer, or offer any indication of where we might look for him. But it will provide a few nails in his coffin once we have him in custody.
If we ever do.
Matt paused, then went on briskly.
We can't be absolutely positive, but last night and this morning I've had my people double-checking with the families, and in the case of Jill Kirkwood, searching her home, Becky Smith, according to her mother, almost always wore a thin gold chain. It wasn't found on the body and isn't in her jewelry box at home. Ivy's mother claims she always wore a peacock pin to church, and there's been no sign of one. Panties are missing from the Ramsey girl's effects, so we can assume that he took something from Jill Kirkwood as well, even though we have no clue as to what that is.
Trophies, Bishop said.
He'll have the items in his possession,
Probably in a drawer or box. Like you said, it'll help. If we catch him. Matt sighed. You'll catch him. The one mistake he's consistently made is to operate in a small area within a close-knit community. Sooner or later, he'll have an identifiable connection to one of his victims.
Yeah, Matt said. But how many victims will he get before we get him?
There wasn't a lot of traffic on the roads because of a night of sleet and a cold, overcast morning. But that was all to the good. And he doubted they would be expecting anything so soon. So that was good as well. But the best thing of all, he thought, was that they would never, in a million years, expect him to lure his target from such an unquestionably safe haven. The church bells began to ring, and he smiled. They spent most of Sunday morning in bed, getting up around 10, only after Max insisted, in canine terms, that enough was enough. But it wasn't until they had finished their late breakfast and cleaned up the kitchen that Cassie reluctantly brought up a touchy subject. I really should try again. Ben's mouth tightened, but his voice was calm when he said, You tried yesterday when Matt got back to his office, and you were still being blocked. Why would today be different?
Ben, he can't keep blocking me indefinitely. Sooner or later, I'll be able to get through. Frankly, I'd rather it was sooner. Don't you want this to be over?
Of course I do. It's just that it takes so much out of you, Cassie.
Only when I actually make contact. She gazed at him steadily. Testing the waters isn't hard at all. And we have to know. If he's stalking somebody else. If he's planning to kill again soon.
Cassie.
Once. Just once. I'd like to be able to tell Matt something other than where to find the latest body.
Ben came to her and wrapped his arms around her, holding her close. I know.
She rested her cheek against him, her own arms lifting in a gesture that was still tentative and sliding around his waist. She wondered if he had any idea at all that he was the first person since her mother's death to offer a comforting hug. There can't be any peace as long as he's out there.
I know.
And almost anything would be better than this damned music, she said somewhat ruefully.
That's still bugging you.
She drew away from him, not made uncomfortable by the physical contact, but so unaccustomed that she was hyper-aware of it. The moment I'm not thinking about anything, it creeps back in.
Identify the song and it'll go away.
Probably. Cassie shook her head. Never mind. I just need to concentrate on something.
Ben didn't protest again.
They left Max in the kitchen working on a rawhide treat while they went into the living room so Cassie could get comfortable. When she did have something to concentrate on, focusing on the effort to touch the killer's mind, she once more encountered a block she was unable to get past. Damn.
You said he couldn't block you indefinitely. Ben reminded her.
I know, but the block feels awfully solid. She reached up to rub her forehead. This damned music.
Do you often get an unidentifiable tune in your head?
No, almost never. She stared at him, suddenly very uneasy. Almost never. When you're tone deaf, music isn't something that sticks in your mind. And this sounds like it's coming from a music box. I haven't listened to a music box in a long, long time.
Before Ben could respond, the phone rang.
Cassie had to get up from the sofa to reach the receiver, since it was on a side table. Hello? Ben saw her face tighten as she listened for a moment. Then she cradled the receiver.
He was on his feet and moving toward her without thought.
Cassie?
Wrong number, she said softly. He put his hands on her shoulders and turned her to face him.
I don't think so. What did they say?
Nothing important. She let out a small laugh that sounded more resigned than amused. Remember, you said I'd probably get a few calls from upset and suspicious citizens? That was one. But don't worry. I've been called worse things than a witch, believe me.
Damn it.
Ben pulled her into his arms and held her.
There had to be a few, I guess. But most of the people around here are pretty tolerant, Cassie. They're just afraid and panicked right now.
I know. I'm all right, really. He drew back just far enough to be able to kiss her, the first reassuring touch rapidly becoming something else. His hands slid down her back to her hips, holding her tighter against him, and Cassie made a muted sound of pure pleasure. She felt a little embarrassed when he raised his head to smile down at her, but the look in his eyes was familiar evidence of his own arousal.
Have I mentioned that I have a very difficult time keeping my hands off you? He asked, his hands moving caressingly.
Cassie cleared her throat, but her voice still emerged huskily. You haven't? No. But I've sort of noticed since last night.
I've said it before. For a man with thick walls, there's a lot I can't seem to hide.
She considered that. To be honest, I'm glad. I'm not experienced in these matters, so I'm very grateful you haven't kept me guessing. He chuckled.
No, I haven't done that.
Because of my lack of experience? She asked curiously.
Because I can't keep my hands off you.
He kissed her again, hunger unmistakable. Against her mouth, he added hoarsely,
I am so glad you changed your mind about us. I don't know how much longer I could have stood it.
Cassie slid her arms up around his neck, rising on tiptoe because the fit was better. Much better. It's probably a good thing I can't read you.
Why?
He was exploring her throat. Never mind. Ben raised his head and looked at her.
Why? He repeated.
She was embarrassed now. Let's just say I'm having a hard time understanding why you want me.
If you're talking about all that baggage again, I don't know why you thought it would keep me away. Everybody past the age of 21 has baggage of some kind. Or should.
He shrugged.
God knows you haven't seemed too worried about mine.
Cassie was glad he was focused on the emotional aspects. She really didn't want to have to explain that it was his physical passion for her she found somewhat baffling. How bad can yours be? She asked, easing further away from the question of desire.
Oh, mine's textbook.
He returned to exploring her throat.
Domineering father, childlike mother who didn't have the faintest idea how to be a parent. Boring stuff.
His voice was deliberately light, almost flippant. Looks to me like you grew up just fine, despite that, she told him, allowing her fingers to venture into his hair and enjoying the sensations.
And yet, there are these walls.
They seem to worry you a lot more than they do me, she commented absently. Wondering if Max would be very upset if they went back to bed.
I hope that's a good sign rather than a bad one.
Cassie was saved from having to reply when he kissed her, and her response was even more passionate, because this talk of baggage and walls had reminded her that fate would seldom be denied. When the phone rang again, she could have sworn aloud, and Ben did, and he was the one who answered it, with considerable annoyance that was heightened by his suspicion that it was another crank call.
Am I interrupting something?
Matt asked, and then went on immediately.
Never mind. Sorry to intrude on your love life, but we have this killer running around. You may remember.
I do, Ben told him. What's up?
A couple of maybe interesting developments. I think we should have a council of war. Can you and Cassie come to the office?
Ben resisted the impulse to say no. With Cassie in his arms, her slender body pressed fully against his, it was more than a little difficult to think about anything else.
Ben?
Recalling that the killer knew who Cassie was and posed a huge threat to her safety, made him answer,
We're on our way.
Be careful on the roads. Slippery as hell out there.
Right.
As he hung up the phone, Cassie said dryly, I gather we're leaving?
Yes, damn it.
Ben held her against him for a moment longer, then eased away. And it didn't take a psychic to see his reluctance.
Matt wants to talk to us. And he'd better have something important to say.
Cassie sighed. I'll get my jacket. Abby?
Hannah Payne stood in the doorway of one of the classrooms and looked in to see Abby collecting the lesson books left behind by her Sunday school class.
Hi, Hannah.
What's up?
Kate and Donna are handling the nursery during preaching, so I'm free. Do you need me to do anything?
There's nothing I can think of, unless you want to finish up in here while I go upstairs and make sure the music is in place.
Sure. Happy to.
Okay, thanks. See you upstairs. Alone in the basement room, Hannah gathered the lesson books and put them away in a cabinet, then straightened the chairs and picked up a pair of gloves somebody had dropped. Men's gloves. Black leather and very nice. She turned one in her hands, studying it, wondering if Joe would like a pair for his birthday the following month. He didn't usually wear gloves, but... The wetness she felt on two of the fingers stained her own hand pink. Staring, Hannah felt a chill of unease. Just paint, probably, or something like that. A sound from the doorway spun her around with her heart in her throat.
What have you got there? He asked.
No luck, huh? Matt asked.
No, sorry.
This time Cassie and Ben were on the leather sofa, while Bishop occupied one of the visitors' chairs in the sheriff's office. Cassie had just attempted once more to contact the killer's mind, without success.
Matt shrugged.
Worth a try.
I'll try again later, Cassie said.
He nodded.
Well, like I told you to. We have a bit more on the killer, we think. He's collecting trophies, and maybe he killed Ivy Jameson out of spite. We've got a growing list of people Ivy pissed off in the weeks before she was killed, so it looks like the trick there is going to be narrowing the list to something manageable.
The music in Cassie's head was beginning to madden her, but she said,
Matt, remember what I told you yesterday? What Lucy Shaw said to me?
I remember. That somebody was the devil.
What do you think about that?
He lifted an eyebrow at her.
Not much, I have to say. She's on the shady side of crazy, Cassie, and has been for more than 10 years.
What about her son?
What about him?
Is there... Does he have any connection to any of the victims?
She rubbed her forehead irritably.
Russell? Not that I know of.
Almost to herself, she muttered, He had a jacket on yesterday, so I didn't see his wrists. But the hands could have been right. I think.
Ben was watching her closely.
But you said you didn't see anything in Lucy's mind you could identify, except kittens.
No, I didn't. Just a feeling. She returned his gaze, frowning. I've missed something. I know I have.
And there was something about meeting Lucy and her son that's really bothering me. Something I saw, or didn't see, or just didn't understand. Ben looked at the sheriff.
Who's their doctor, Matt? Do you know?
Monroe, I think. Why?
Will he be in church?
Matt shook his head.
After doing that autopsy first thing this morning, I figure he'll be at his desk drinking straight scotch. What do you want me to ask him? If Russell Shaw ever tried to commit suicide.
Matt pursed his lips, then reached for the phone.
Bishop, who had heard Lucy Shaw's story the previous day, said to Cassie, "Serial killers are rarely insane in any clinical sense, so it's highly unlikely he could have inherited a mental illness from his mother."
That isn't what I'm thinking.
What then?
Ever since Ben told me about her, I've wondered what it was that triggered Lucy's illness. And after meeting her, I don't think she has Alzheimer's or senility or anything like that. I think something happened to her, some kind of shock that shattered her mind.
Ben said, such as discovering that she might have spawned a psychopath in the shape of her son?
Could be. Cassie rubbed her forehead again.
The music again?
Yes, damn it.
Music? Bishop was still watching her. You're hearing music in your mind?
Yes, but I haven't gone crazy, so don't get your hopes up.
Matt hung up the phone and said, Doc's going to check his records. He made noises about confidentiality, but if he finds what we're looking for, he'll call back.
Bishop said to Cassie,
how long have you been hearing the music?
Off and on since yesterday morning.
Since you woke up after the last contact with the killer's mind? After he caught you there?
Cassie nodded slowly. Yes. Since then. Her head hurt. There was something over her head, her face, some dark material. For an instant, the fear of smothering was uppermost in her mind, but then she realized that her wrists were bound behind her back. She was sitting on something cold and hard, and behind her was... She made her fingers explore hesitantly and identified what felt like exposed pipe, cold and impossible to budge. Her wrists were bound together on the other side of the pipe, with a belt, she thought. That wouldn't budge either, though she tried. And she heard the music first, muffled by the bag over her head. The tinkling sound nevertheless identified it as coming from a music box. And it was playing Swan Lake. Behind it, beyond it, was another sound. A muffled, roaring sound that she knew she ought to be able to identify, but couldn't. That realization had barely registered in her mind when she heard another sound, the faint scuffling of shoes against a rough floor, and she understood with a jolt of terror that she was not alone. He was there. Instinctively, in total panic, she wrenched against the belt binding her wrists, succeeding in doing nothing except hurting herself and drawing his attention.
Oh, so you're awake, are you?
Please, she heard herself say shakily. Please, don't hurt me. Don't. The bag was jerked off her head, and she blinked in the sudden wash of light. At first, all she saw were bare bulbs hanging down, and across the room, some hulking machinery with a small glass window that showed a fire inside. A fire? I'm so glad you're awake. His voice was incongruously cheerful. She looked up at him, focused on his face, and felt nothing but uncomprehending surprise. You...
I just love the first moment of astonishment, he said,
then bent down and slapped her across the face brutally with the flat of his big hand. And the first moment of fear.
Could the music be coming from him? Bishop asked.
He isn't psychic, not yet, Cassie objected. So how could he be sending me anything?
Maybe he isn't sending it.
Maybe he's put it in his mind, the way any person might recite a rhyme or count or calculate, in order to block out something. You. Maybe you've been touching his mind all along, and he's fighting to keep you out.
Is that possible?
Ben asked her. I don't know. I suppose so. It might be a clever way to keep me out without expending much effort, distracting me with the music.
Matt said, Does that mean you might be able to get through now?
I can try.
She did try.
But knowledge that the killer could be using that endless tune to distract her was no help at all. He has solid walls, she said, opening her eyes with a sigh. And I don't understand that. There's no way he could have built them so quickly, not to protect himself from a recently perceived threat. And he didn't have them earlier, or I wouldn't have connected to him the way I did. The phone rang then, and Matt answered it quickly. He said hello, then yeah, a couple of times, his eyes narrowing. It was a short conversation, and when he hung up after a brief thanks, he was grim.
What? Ben demanded.
Russell Shaw never tried to commit suicide as far as Doc Monroe knows.
But?
Ben asked, hearing the word in his friend's voice.
But his son did.
Mike Shaw apparently slit his wrists about 12 years ago when he was only 14. His son? Cassie echoed. Lucy's grandson?
Yeah. The mother died in childbirth with Mike. Russell and Lucy raised him. He lived with them until about a year ago, then moved into one of those shacks out by the old mill about a mile from town.
Is there any chance I could have met him? Cassie asked Ben. Grimly, he said,
A good chance, though you probably wouldn't have paid much attention. Mike Shaw is the first shift counterman at the drugstore.
I've met him, Bishop said. He struck me as having a ghoulish interest in the murders. He'd be off on Sundays, Cassie mused, recalling that the drugstore was closed then.
And on one other day, Ben looked at Matt. Can we find out if he was off on Friday at the time the Ramsey girl was taken?
Yeah. Easy enough once church lets out and his boss is back home, but...
Matt hunted through the file folders on his desk and opened one of them. I seem to recall... Oh, shit. Bingo.
What?
Ben asked quickly.
Mike Shaw is one of the people her mother mentioned had a disagreement with Ivy Jameson a few days before she was killed. Seems she ate at the drugstore and wasn't at all pleased with Mike's cooking. Ripped him to shreds, as only Ivy could, in front of his boss and a half dozen customers.
Bishop said,
I would say that probably upset him quite a bit.
He's the right age, Ben noted, and plenty strong enough physically.
Matt frowned. Say we find out if he was off on Friday. Does that give us enough to search his place? Will Judge Hayes sign a warrant, Ben?
In this case? Yes, Ben said. He'll sign a warrant.
Mike, why are you doing this? She kept her voice as steady as possible, even though she had never been so terrified in her life. He made a sound and shook his head. Because I can, of course. Because I want to. His attention was caught by the slowing of the music box, and he walked quickly across the concrete floor to a heavy old table where the box was sitting. He picked it up and wound it, then set it back on the table. "There," he murmured to himself. There was an old iron cot a few feet away from her against one cinder-block wall, and she glanced toward it, fear spiraling. Surely he didn't mean to. "Mike, I want you to shut up now." His tone was pleasant. "Just shut up and watch." He opened a battered leather duffel bag that was also on the table and began removing things from it. A butcher knife, a hatchet, a power drill. "Oh, God," she whispered. "I wonder if there's a receptacle down here," he muttered, staring around with a scowl. "Damn it, should have checked that." "Mike, oh, look, there's a receptacle." He turned his head and smiled at her. "Right behind you." His intercom buzzed, and Matt reached for the button impatiently. "Yeah?" "Sheriff, a lady named Hannah Payne is on the line for you," Sharon Watkins said. "She says it's important, and I think you'd better talk to her." Sharon had more experience in the department than he did, so Matt tended to respect her judgment. "All right. Line 4. "Thanks, Sharon." He punched the correct line and then turned on the speaker. "Sheriff Dunbar, you wanted to speak to me, Miss Payne?"
"Oh, yes, Sheriff, I did." Hers was a young voice, and uncertain, and also very frightened.
Matt consciously gentled his own voice. "What about, Miss Payne?"
"Well, it's... Joe came into the classroom when I found them, and he says I probably shouldn't bother you, and on a Sunday and all. But I'm just so worried, Sheriff. They were just there, in the classroom, like he forgot them. And I think there's blood on them, and now she's gone."
"Patient," Matt said. "Start at the beginning, Miss Payne. Where are you, and what did you find?"
"Oh, I'm at the church, Sheriff, Oak Creek Baptist, and I found a pair of black gloves in one of the Sunday school classrooms, a man's gloves, and I think they have blood on them because they're all wet and it's coming off pink on my hands."
Tension crept into Matt's voice. "I see. Is there a label in the gloves, Miss Payne? Do you have any idea who they might belong to?"
"Well, that's why I'm worried, because the initials inside say M.S., all nicely embroidered the way Miss Lucy can do, and he's in her Sunday school class, so it must be Mike. But he isn't upstairs in preaching because I checked. And she's gone, too, when she was supposed to play the organ. And I know she wouldn't have left without getting somebody else to play. Not when she told me she was going to check on the music."
"Hannah," Matt's voice was insistent. "Who's gone? Who are you talking about?"
"Abby. Mrs. Montgomery."
Chapter 19. "See? You really shouldn't have been mean to me, Abby," Mike said gently.
"Mean to you? Mike, when was I ever mean to you?"
The only clear thought Abby had was to keep him talking, to stall, delay the inevitable. She had no idea what time it was, how long before Matt came to pick her up and found her missing from church. How would he find her in this place, wherever it was? A basement, she thought. But where was it? There was nothing familiar that she could see, no sight or sound to tell her what building loomed above this dim and musty-smelling room. "That loan." He picked up the butcher knife and held it point up to study the shiny blade. "That loan I needed to get that cool 95 Mustang back before Christmas? You really should have given me the money, Abby." She didn't bother to explain income versus debt to him. Instead, she said strongly,
I'm sorry, Mike.
Yeah, sure you are. Now.
She swallowed hard, almost hypnotized by the way he kept turning the blade of the butcher knife. Keep talking. Just keep talking. What about Jill Kirkwood? How was she mean to you, Mike?
She laughed at me. Her and Becky. They both laughed at me. I saw them.
He put the knife down for a moment to once more wind the music box, then picked up the knife and frowned at it. How do you know they were talking about you, Mike? His head snapped around with the speed of a striking cobra, and his young, pleasant face was twisted into an ugly mask of bitter hate. Can't you hear good? I saw them. Heads together, giggling. Of course they were talking about me. Laughing at me. But they're not laughing now, are they, Abby? And I bet you wish you'd loaned me that money now, don't you?
Yes, she whispered. Yes, Mike, I do.
Matt's fear was a palpable force in the room, and it was almost impossible for Cassie to close out his emotions, but she tried.
Music, she murmured, her eyes closed. I keep getting flashes of a music box. I think he's playing it, but... Damn, I can't get through.
Oh, Christ, Matt said hollowly. Can you reach Abby? Ben asked quietly.
Not with her walls.
Even now?
Especially now. They've been built up over years, over a lifetime, designed to protect the mind and spirit, so the habit is to withdraw even more thoroughly inside them when there's trouble. Damn. If I can just find a way past the music.
It was Bishop who said, Don't try to get past it. Let it carry you in. Concentrate on the music box.
She opened her eyes and stared at him a moment, then shut them and concentrated fiercely. The music. The box. I can see it. There are two dancers twirling around each other, bobbing.
Abby looked at the music box, because it terrified her so much to look at the knife he held. It was one of those cheap little music boxes that tended to be gifts early in a little girl's life, cardboard covered with ribbed pink paper that was stained and faded. The lid was mirrored on the inside, and the mirror was cracked in at least three places. In the box between two removable velvet-covered trays, two tiny dancer figurines bobbed and twirled around each other in jerky accompaniment to the tinkling music.
Swan Lake, she thought. Swan Song. Was Mike clever enough for that? She didn't think so. The box was probably just something from his childhood, the significance of which she would never know. Matt, where are you?
I think we've talked enough, Mike said, turning to smile at her. He was holding the butcher knife. Abby swallowed.
The music box, Mike. It's slowing down again.
He looked over his shoulder, then turned back to pick up the box.
Mustn't let that happen, he murmured. Mustn't let the music stop.
Cassie frowned.
Can't let the music stop. He can't let the music stop. He wants her to hear the music, to listen to it, because then she... He won't let me in. That's it. He's playing the music to shut me out. But I can feel him now. I can feel his heart beating.
Ben said,
Cassie, can you see what he sees? Can you see where he is?
She tilted her head a bit, as though listening, then said, He's still in the church. The old boiler room in the sub-basement. It's soundproof, and he knows nobody will ever think to search for them there, especially since he's shut me out.
The church is 5 minutes away. Matt was out of his chair and bolting for the door, even as Cassie's voice trailed off, with Bishop right behind him. It was the agent who snapped softly, Start bringing her out, now.
Ben nodded, but kept his eyes on Cassie's pale face.
Cassie, I want you to come back to me, love.
I don't want to. Abby is so alone.
Cassie, you can't help her now. Come back.
But he's getting ready. He didn't have time to get the cot ready when he brought it here early this morning. So now he is, tying the ropes to the frame for her wrists and ankles. He wants to play with her for a long, long time.
Ben knew time was running out, for Abby and for Cassie, but he had to ask, Has he hurt her yet? Has he hurt Abby?
He knocked her out so no one would know he grabbed her. But she's awake now. She's trying to talk to him, to reason with him. He doesn't mind, because he thinks he has all the time in the world. But he's getting more excited. He likes watching her try to save herself. He wonders if she'll scream the way the last bitch did. He liked that.
Her voice trailed away, and she caught her breath. What is it, Cassie? What do you see?
Not see. Feel. His boots are too tight. They're still too tight.
Cassie looked puzzled.
Why doesn't he take them off?
She fell silent, brows drawn together. Cassie? That's enough, Cassie. You have to get out of his mind now. You have to come back to me.
For a moment, it seemed Cassie would continue to resist his command, but then she let herself relax taut muscles. A moment later, she opened her eyes slowly, and even more slowly turned her head to look at him. Matt, better hurry, she whispered. Ben pulled her into his arms, feeling her shiver against him.
He'll get there in time, he said,
wishing he could be as sure of that as he sounded. The cruiser took the corner on two wheels. Bishop hung on until all four wheels were on the street again, and then returned to checking out his weapon.
How many doors? He asked.
Just one.
The sheriff's voice was level, with the sort of calm more dangerous than nitroglycerin in a paper cup, and Bishop shot him a quick, assessing look.
Windows? No, it's a sub-basement. The only way in is through one heavy wooden door at the base of a flight of wooden steps we access from the primary basement.
Can the door be locked?
Not from the inside. With the old furnace in that room, it's a safety issue. Unless the bastard has added his own hardware, of course.
I hate to assume he hasn't, Bishop said.
Then we won't. We assume he's got the door locked or barred from the inside, which means we have one shot, and only one, to surprise him. If we don't get through the first time, he knows we're out there, and he has time to hold a knife to Abby's throat.
If he hasn't already.
But Bishop didn't say that. Of course.
He used the butcher knife to cut lengths of rope from a heavy coil, then left the knife on the table beside the music box. It had taken him several minutes, but he had the cot ready now, with the lengths of rope tied to the iron frame to bind her wrists and ankles. He had wound the music box several more times while working,
not once losing patience with the interruptions. That single-mindedness terrified Abby more than anything else.
"Matt, where are you?"
She had tried her best to loosen the belt wrapped around her wrists, but once again had done nothing except hurt herself. The pipe behind her was solidly in the wall and in the cement floor, and God knew how deep in the earth beneath it. There was no way she could free herself. Mike went to wind the music box again. He picked up the butcher knife for a moment and stared at it, then put it down beside the box and came toward her.
"Don't."
Ignoring her strangled plea, he hunkered beside her and reached around to her wrists. For an instant, the belt tightened almost unbearably, then loosened abruptly. Abby knew at once that she was still helpless. As the blood rushed into her numbed fingers, they tingled and throbbed and were virtually useless. And when Mike grabbed her arms and hauled her up with dreadful strength, her knees buckled and she sagged against him.
"Mike, please don't hurt me."
Her voice shook with terror, and the sound of her own paralyzing fear brought back vivid memories of her cowering beneath Gary's punishing fists, pleading with him to stop, not to hurt her anymore. Nobody had come to save her then. Nobody would come to save her now. As Mike began to drag her toward the cot, Abby found the strength to dig in her heels, to struggle against him.
"No. God damn you, it's not going to be that easy."
She caught him off guard and got one wild swing at his jaw that actually connected and rocked his head back. For a second, his grip loosened and Abby wrenched herself away. She got two stumbling steps away before she felt his hands close around her throat from behind, felt herself jerked back against the solid wall of muscle that was his chest.
"Bitch,"
he snarled, fingers tightening.
"Fucking bitch! I'll teach you! I'll teach you!"
Her fingers plucked desperately at his in a vain attempt to loosen them. Blackness swam across her vision, and she sagged once more against him as the newly found strength drained out of her legs in a rush.
"I saw him kill you, Abby. I couldn't see his face, and I don't know who he is, but he was enraged, cursing, and his hands were on your throat."
Oh, God. Alexandra had been right after all. Fate couldn't be changed. It was very quiet when they reached the heavy oak door, and the light from the basement above barely illuminated the wooden steps behind them. Matt was acutely conscious of every soft creak beneath the feet of the deputy a few steps behind him in Bishop. His fears fixed on what lay beyond, Matt curled his fingers over the knob and turned it slowly. But when he leaned against the unlocked door, it refused to budge. Still moving slowly, despite every instinct screaming inside him, he eased back. Bishop bent down and used a tiny penlight to study the door. "Looks like a new bolt might have been installed on the inside," he whispered. Matt looked at the shotgun the agent carried and tried to swallow the dryness of terror.
"Then we'll have to blast our way in.
If we're quick enough, the surprise should give us a few seconds before he can act." A few seconds. Dear God. Matt looked at the pistol in his hand. He thumbed off the safety and held it ready.
"You blast the door. I go in first."
They shifted position and Bishop aimed his shotgun.
"Ready? Go."
The sudden roar of the shotgun was deafening. Bishop followed it with a powerful kick to the door and it crashed open. Matt was moving even as he registered the scene inside, even as he saw that most of his worst fears had come true. Near the center of the room, Abby slumped back against Mike Shaw, her throat surrounded by his powerful hands. Her own hands fell limply at her sides, and her knees buckled as the life was squeezed out of her. An animal-like bellow escaping from somewhere deep inside him, Matt charged across the few feet separating him and Abby.
His wild gaze was on her, but he saw Mike start to turn, his young face twisted into a horrible mask of rage. Matt didn't hesitate. He swung his gun and slammed the butt against the bridge of Mike's nose. His fingers instantly released Abby to claw at his own face. Then, before he could do more than draw a lungful of breath to howl in pain, Matt kicked the back of his knee, and he went sprawling. Matt left him for Bishop and the deputies. He dropped to the floor beside Abby's limp body and gathered her into his arms, feeling himself begin to shake. "Abby? Honey, please." At first, Abby thought it was all over. But then she heard an ungodly noise, was dimly aware of Mike jerking behind her, of his fingers tightening almost convulsively. There was no more air, and the blackness filled everything, and she was falling. "Abby? Abby? Honey, open your eyes. Look at me, Abby. Look at me." Matt's voice. She tried to swallow and found that her throat hurt terribly. Tried to open her eyes and had to fight against the weight holding them shut. He was cradling her in his arms, his expression so fierce that it would have frightened her if any other man had worn it. But it was easy for Abby to smile at Matt. "Hello," she whispered through her very sore throat. He groaned and gathered her even closer, and over his shoulder, Abby saw Mike sprawled out on the floor, cursing steadily while his hands were being cuffed behind his back by one of Matt's deputies. His nose was bleeding. Bishop stood near the table, looking down at the music box that no longer played, at the butcher knife Mike had been too many steps away from. The agent was holding a shotgun, which explained the explosion of sound Abby vaguely recalled hearing. They must have used that to blast through the door and distract Mike long enough to let them get inside the room. Talk about an 11th-hour rescue. Abby managed to get her arms up around Matt's neck and whispered, "What do you know? This time somebody came." March 1st, 1999. "The really unexpected thing," Ben said after hanging up the phone the next afternoon, "is that Hannah Payne probably saved her own life as well as Abby's. Matt says they found Polaroids at Mike Shaw's house, all the victims before and after he grabbed them, and he had one each of Abby and Hannah. So she was intended to be next. She told Matt she got a creepy phone call the other day, the same as Abby did. Abby thought hers came from Gary, but he swore not."
"Before or after Matt hit him?" Ben chuckled.
"After, I think. Gary Montgomery is a very subdued man, I'd say. Matt made it perfectly plain to him that if Abby gets so much as a hangnail in the next 30 or 40 years, Gary is dead meat. And given the fact that Matt was just this side of sane after nearly losing her to a serial killer, I have no doubts that Gary believed every word."
"Neither do I." Ben sat down beside her on the sofa and shook his head.
"I still can't get over it. Mike Shaw, serial killer. Christ. He worked on my campaign."
"Is he saying anything?"
"Not much, no. And since the county public defender has already announced she'll resign before taking him on as a client, and his father refuses to hire any other attorney, not that one has come forward to offer, questioning him is a bit of a problem."
"How will it be solved?"
"We're going outside the county, to somebody who won't have to live here after the trial. Judge Hayes already has calls in to a couple of good lawyers, and one of them's bound to take the case, for the notoriety, if nothing else. And then again, when the news breaks in the major newspapers, there'll probably be at least a few hotshots outside the state who'll sell their souls for the case."
"But you'll prosecute?"
"Damned right. His lawyer will argue for a change of venue, but no matter where the case is tried, I will prosecute."
"Good. Did I hear you say something about Bishop?"
Matt says he's sticking around for a while, lending his expertise in gathering and cataloging all the evidence they're turning up at Mike's house.
Ben paused, then went on carefully.
Which, of course, wouldn't have anything to do with you. Him staying, I mean.
Cassie looked at him, smiling faintly.
Not a thing.
He eyed her.
Uh-huh.
Don't you have to be in court today? I mean, I know the county prosecutor has a certain amount of leeway, but most of them work Mondays, I thought.
I'm taking some well-deserved time off before getting to work on the biggest case this county has ever seen. The legal system won't grind to a halt without me for a few days.
Cassie was thoughtful. I see. Which, of course, wouldn't have anything to do with me.
It's Max. I can't bear to abandon him.
She glanced toward the dog, who was snoring softly on his rug near the fireplace. Yes. He's obviously the clinging sort. Ben grinned at her.
Okay. We both know you're not. And I know you're not in danger any longer, not even from crank calls, given that the mayor is ready to hand you the key to the town after Matt made it clear you saved Abby's life and helped him catch the killer.
I hope you'll tell his honor I don't want the key to the town. Cassie was uncomfortable, both with that idea and with the growing certainty that Ben had something on his mind. I'm glad I was able to help there at the end. But nothing's really changed, Ben.
Hasn't it?
He was grave now, watchful. No. I'm not part of the town. I moved out here for peace and quiet, just like my aunt did. Cassie shrugged. She managed to live here for 20 years without getting involved, and I imagine I will, too.
You're already involved, Cassie. You did something Alexandra never did. Put yourself at risk for the people here.
I didn't have much choice. You know that.
You had a choice. You could have run away, avoided the whole problem, and left it up to us to catch Mike. But you stayed, and you helped.
She drew a breath. You also know it was an extraordinary event. Probably once in a lifetime for this town. It won't happen again.
So you mean to bury yourself out here? Go into town only when you have to? Take Alexandra's place as the town eccentric?
There are worse fates, she murmured.
What about us, Cassie?
She turned her head to look at the fire they had going, because it was a cold day with occasional snow flurries, and thought again of her aunt's prediction about Abby's ultimate fate. Alex had been wrong. Or knowing about it had somehow enabled Abby to change what might otherwise have happened. She might have been wrong about Ben, too. And Cassie might have been wrong when she had seen her own fate. There was at least a chance of that. Wasn't there?
Cassie.
She was afraid to look at him. I don't know. I guess I just assumed it would go on for a while, until you got tired of me.
Tired of you?
He put his hands on her shoulders and turned her to face him.
Cassie, are you under the impression this is just an affair?
She stared at him. What else could it be?
Something a lot more permanent.
He touched her face with gentle fingers, brushed back a strand of silky black hair.
I hope.
Of all the possibilities she might have considered, that one had never even occurred to her. And Cassie was more than a little surprised it had occurred to him. Slowly, she said, I think it's a little early to be talking about anything permanent, don't you? I mean, neither one of us was looking for any kind of commitment.
Maybe not, but...
Ben, you know there's no maybe about it. I've been shying away from people most of my life.
And it's obvious you aren't ready for any kind of long-term commitment.
How is it obvious?
Then he realized.
Oh. My walls.
It didn't take a psychic to see that the reminder disturbed him, and Cassie conjured a rueful smile. We're still getting to know each other. Still learning to trust. Let's give us time, Ben, okay? Time without outside pressures like serial killers pushing us towards something we're not ready for yet. There's no hurry, is there?
I suppose not.
He pulled her into his arms, smiling, but with something of a frown lingering in his eyes.
As long as you don't intend to kick me out of your bed any time soon.
That, Cassie said, sliding her arms up around his neck, was never part of my plan. He got dressed and went downstairs, discovering Cassie in the living room. The smell of something good cooking wafted from the kitchen, and she was busy packing away the stacks of papers and journals that had lain on the coffee table for the past few days. He paused for a moment in the doorway to watch her, conscious of a constriction in his chest and a cold knot of unease in the pit of his stomach. Had he made a mistake? His common sense had told him to wait, to be careful not to make demands, but other instincts had insisted that Cassie know how he felt. Ben thought she cared for him. He thought that given her past and almost pathological reluctance to allow anyone even the most casual of physical contact, she would have been unable to accept him as her lover if she hadn't cared, if she hadn't trusted him at least partly. But he also knew that Cassie's past experiences with the dark violence of too many male minds made it almost impossible for her to completely trust a man, especially when she couldn't read him. His damned walls. She wouldn't commit herself to him until she was sure of him, and his walls made that impossible. Even if he managed to pull the walls down, Ben wasn't sure it would bring Cassie to his side and his life for good. She had been alone for a long time, had convinced herself that being alone was the best way for her. Would she, could she, change her life so drastically by accepting him and all the people and responsibilities he would bring with him? He didn't know. Ben arranged his features to express pleasant companionship and went into the living room.
You abandoned me,
he accused Cassie lightly. She smiled. I got hungry. Sorry. Spaghetti. I hope you like it.
Love it.
He wanted to touch her, but forced himself not to make his need for her so damned obvious.
What are you doing in here?
Packing away this stuff.
I thought you were going to read the journals.
Cassie sent him a glance he couldn't interpret to save his life and murmured, Sometimes it's best not to know how things turn out.
Are we talking about Alexandra?
She looked at the journal in her hand, then added it to the other stuff in the box. Of course. He didn't think so, but accepted what she said, wary of pushing her when she seemed so elusive.
Well, you can always read them later.
Yes. Later. Cassie closed the box, then looked at him, smiling. The sauce should be ready if you are.
I'm ready. He moved very carefully, wary of the dog's keen ears, even with the noise of sleet and wind. Caution told him to stay back, but he wanted to get closer, close enough to see inside. So cozy in there. A nice fire in the fireplace. Lights and the appetizing aroma of good food making the kitchen warm and snug. Quiet voices that were comfortable with each other and yet aware. The edges of their words blurred with longing, with hope and uncertainty and fear. They were completely wrapped up in each other. They were oblivious of his watching eyes. He stood outside, his collar turned up and hat pulled low to protect his face from the stinging sleet. It was cold,
The ground was frozen, and his feet were cold inside the thin shoes. But he remained where he was for a long time, watching. She hadn't understood. All his work, and she hadn't understood. Hadn't understood he had done it all for her. But she would. Soon.
March 2nd, 1999.
So much for time off, Ben said,
nodding his tie as Cassie lay in bed watching him.
Trust Judge Hayes to make me come back to work.
Well, he's right, she said. Now that Mike Shaw has a lawyer, and most of the evidence has been collected from his house, it's time for you to go to work.
Do you have to be so reasonable?
Ben came to sit on the edge of the bed, smiling down at her.
I'm being driven out of a very warm bed on a very cold morning, and I intend to bitch about it.
She reached up to touch his face, in one of those hesitant little gestures that always stopped his heart. The warm bed will be here waiting for you when you get back. That is...
Oh, I'm definitely coming back, he assured her. For lunch, if I can manage it. By 5, if I can't. Either way, I'll bring takeout. Any preferences?
No. I'm easy to please.
Yes, he said, bending to kiss her. You are. Try to go back to sleep, love. I'll take Max out and feed him before I leave. See you later.
Cassie listened to the faint sounds of his leaving, then curled up with her arms wrapped around his pillow and breathed in the faint scent of him that clung to the linen. Already he was marking his presence in her life. Her bed smelled of him, and the scent of his aftershave lingered in the room. His toiletries were on the bathroom counter beside hers. One of his shirts lay across the chair in the corner. Something permanent. She shied away from thinking about that, because it was so astonishing and potentially wonderful, and she didn't trust the possibility of it. Her life had taught her that wonderful things simply didn't happen to her, and she had learned to eye happy surprises with suspicion. There was always a catch. But until she discovered what that was, Cassie just wanted to enjoy the moment, to luxuriate in contentment. She was in a warm bed, where a warm man had lain beside her all night, and every muscle in her body was blissfully weary. He was a very passionate man. Smiling to herself as she remembered that passion, Cassie drifted off to sleep. When the ringing woke her, she thought it was her alarm, and peered at the nightstand resentfully. But then the phone rang again, and she pulled herself across the bed to answer it. Hello? Cassie, will you please tell Ben to get his ass over here? Matt requested in a harassed voice. That damn defense lawyer made some phone calls on his way here, and now I'm hip deep in the media. The national media. I don't want to talk to them. That's Ben's job, dammit. She reached to turn the clock toward her, and a cold hand closed around her heart. Matt, he left here more than 2 hours ago. Chapter 20. There was a long silence, and then Matt said carefully, "The roads are a mess. Maybe he stopped to pull somebody out of a ditch. He has chains in that Jeep of his and a winch. That's probably it. I'll send a patrol car out that way." He would have called. He would have called one of us. Maybe he hasn't had time. Don't make yourself crazy before we know if there's a reason. Cassie's throat was so dry she could hardly swallow. I'm coming to town, she said. Cassie, listen to me. I wasn't kidding about the media. There are 3 news vans parked in front of the station, and the place is crawling with press. You do not want to be here. Matt, you stay put. I'll check it out and call you the minute I know something. Hurry, she whispered. Please, hurry. For an endless hour, Cassie paced the floor and bit her nails, her imagination going wild. Even though she knew it would be impossible, she tried to reach out to Ben,
telling herself it simply wasn't conceivable that something could have happened to him without her knowing about it. She would have felt it, surely. All she felt was terror, and it was all hers. When Matt's cruiser pulled up in her driveway, Cassie knew that the news would be bad. Numb with dread, she went out onto the porch to meet Matt and Bishop, and their faces told her that her instincts were right. "He's not dead," she said. "No, he's not dead. At least, we don't think so." Matt took her arm and led her back into the house, and the physical contact made her acutely aware of his worry. Cassie sat down on the sofa, staring from one man to the other. "What do you mean? You don't think so?" Matt sat down beside her. "We found the Jeep, but not Ben. It looks like he stopped to clear a fallen tree from the road. Idiot. The Jeep could have made it over easily. He was thinking about whoever came along behind him."
"I don't understand," Cassie said. "If he wasn't with the Jeep, then where is he? What happened?"
From his position on his feet near the fireplace, Bishop said, "There were tire tracks showing another vehicle came up behind his. And that tree didn't come down naturally."
"You mean some kind of trap?"
Matt nodded. "We think so, Cassie. It looks like someone else stopped, ostensibly to help Ben, then grabbed him, probably after knocking him out. There's